Blog Talk Radio.
Phil, are you there? Phil, are you there?
Hello, Steve.
Hey, hello, this is Stephen.
This is Sally.
Hey, Sally.
I
there
got
you.
In.
Oh,
apparently
good.
Phil isn't in, but
okay.
I got in.
All right, we're getting Phil, too. Hey, Phil.
Good evening, everyone. Stephen, do you think we've identified our technical problem for the evening? Or?
Yeah, we've got our technical problem out of the way, so let's run the front bumper. How about it?
All right.
Hey, Sally.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing well, as well, you know, as can be expected under the circumstances. We really had some trouble getting the show up and going this evening, but maybe, as you said, we've knocked out our technical problem early, and it'll go smooth now.
Yeah, I think we cleared the board on the technical problem for tonight. The thing always to remember, and I guess it always will be, Blog Talk Radio is still in beta, right?
It's sort of like Google Mail, Gmail.
Yeah, it's officially beta forever, right?
Yeah, permanently beta. And
permanently beta. So, you know, yeah, you get these little glitches from time to time. But hey, we improvise, we recover, and here we are having the program. So, all's well that ends well. And it's not just the two of us. We also have our chat host Sally Moran with us. Hello, Sally.
Hello tonight. I hope things go well. Much better than it has been going tonight.
It's already going much better, wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, we're having a show
especially
at all.
When we're getting
to, yeah.
Especially when we're getting into supposedly post-humans society. I hope we get into the post-human radio show technology.
Well, there you go. See, this is exactly the kind of little glitch we're going to have to get through, I think, to get from subhuman to post-human, even in three easy steps, it's going to be it's even harder than that. But you think about how cool it is that we're able to do a show like this. And I want to thank both of you and for our friends listening live for your flexibility for us having the show on Wednesday evening this week instead of Tuesday. Just had some family stuff going on yesterday that precluded my participating in the show. So, Stephen, Sally, thanks for being here on a different night.
Sure.
I'd like to thank my wife, Sherilyn, for being a good sport. It's her birthday today, and we have celebrated already today and everything, but give me an hour away to do the show today. Well, that was very cool of her. So
that is very cool of her. Well, Sherilyn is a cool lady, and a very, very happy birthday to her. 22 years old. It's just hard to believe that.
That's right. 22 years old for 18 years now.
Hey,
work that out mathematically.
It's too hard for me. I'm not trying to add that up. No, that's hard math right there. So while we're on the subject, actually, of obviously you're not out in a fancy restaurant or anything this evening. Just
well, we did. We had a nice lunch together today, and it was her favorite Chinese takeout earlier this evening. So, yeah, she's very happy with that, and we're gonna celebrate. We're having a party this weekend where we're both celebrating our 40th birthdays at the same time this weekend. So that's gonna be cool. So
that's great. Well,
if you guys were closer, y'all of course are invited officially, but I understand if y'all can't make it from where you are. So,
well, that is a longish drive. Now, how long of a drive is it, seeing as you've done it a couple times from where I am to where you are, Stephen?
Oh, let's see. I didn't even bother to add it up. You just get in your car and you drive a long, long time.
You just drive till you get to Shreveport, and
that's right.
That's it. Yeah.
That's right.
When you get to Shreveport, you can stop.
That's right. It's a full day and a half of constant driving, pretty much, is what it amounts to.
Wow.
Yeah.
So, yeah, probably won't make that, but you guys have a great time, and happy birthday to both of you. I didn't realize your birthday. When is your birthday, Steve?
October the 9th. So it's been a while, but, you know, we're a month and 9 days apart in our ages, and so we decided to wait until Sherilyn's birthday, and we're going to kind of have a big to-do since it's a large round number that we're turning this year. So.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, you guys have a great time this weekend, and that is the best thing to do, you know, when your birthday falls on a Wednesday, is definitely to the weekend before or the weekend after. So I commend Sherilyn for the sensibility there, and you guys have a great time. Well, let's dig into our topic this evening. We don't have to spend a lot of time on it since it is three easy steps, but we're going to be talking about the process of transitioning from prehuman or subhuman intelligence to human-level intelligence to post-human intelligence. And this is kind of an eclectic trip we're going to take through this. A few different items out on the web and just kind of rattling around in my head have kind of brought this subject to the fore over the last couple of weeks. And I thought it would be good to spend some time on this. A couple of things I've seen written by our buddy Josh Hall over at Foresight Institute. Some interesting stuff going on over at Accelerating Future with Michael Anisimov. Of course, that's just an interesting blog. I can't recommend Michael's blog enough. I don't even blog at The Speculist enough, I think, because I get caught up in comment threads on Accelerating Future. So I'm personally going to stop reading it, but I recommend everyone else continue to read it. Because
yeah, you're going to stop reading it so you can have something to write at The Speculist. I have time to write that. Huh?
Exactly, yeah. Although I get most of my ideas from Michael. It's mostly, you know, Speculist is mostly just a rehash of, no, not really. Actually, that's not true. We copy a lot of stuff from Brian Wong's blog, too. Just kidding. The interesting thing that kind of got me going on this was a piece that Josh had written over at the Foresight Institute's blog on the hostile robot takeover that we're currently experiencing. I don't know if you saw this piece, Stephen, but he called it the bad robot takeover. And his beef here was phone robots, let's all rebel. And he gives a story that, if you read it, the process of what he goes through there on this call that he's on, you know, you get this burst of Spanish, and they tell you to dial, you know, press 1, give your account number. Well, he was actually calling a company where he didn't have an account. He was actually just looking for some general information, but they're not listed anywhere. The only phone number listed is this one that as soon as you call them, the IVR is saying, give me your account number. So he's hitting zero, and he's doing different things, saying, I don't have an account number and stuff like that. And you know,
maybe they've got all the customers they can handle. Maybe they're not interested in anybody.
They're just done, yeah, recruiting new customers. So a great bit in there when the robot says to him, I don't recognize this number in our records. Is this the phone number for the account you have with our company? And he responds, no, you dummy, it's not. It's my own phone number. But that's not actually what he said. He said, I don't have an account. And, of course, the robot keeps saying, I'm sorry, I don't understand. And it gets absolutely nowhere. And he bemoans the fact that, you know, for someone who has been writing about the robots taking over for a long time now, and this is one of our tropes here at The Speculus and Fast Forward Radio. This is something we talk about, you know, welcoming our robot overlords, but we don't want these robot overlords. And
they need to be a little smarter than that before we'll let them take over. Let's put it that way. They got,
yeah, but unfortunately, they have taken over. They've, you know, there's some transactions where they really are in charge, and it can be extremely frustrating. Now, it can be pretty good, too. I think we talked a while back about I'd had a fairly positive experience with United Airlines, and they've got this kind of narrow AI system where you kind of really feel like you're having a conversation. You go in and you're making a change to your reservation. The dude gives you little choices on what it is you want to do, and you work through them, and it actually feels reasonably like you had a conversation with a person. And at least in my case, that one time, actually I've done this two or three times now, it worked pretty well. But anytime, I guess that's the problem, that's the narrow part of narrow AI. Anytime you go outside of the bounds of what that very tightly governed little program was designed to do, it's lost. And if there's not a human being back there somewhere, if there's not a keep hitting zero option until you get an actual human being, you're completely stuck.
Yeah, yeah.
So, well, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I have to deal with that quite a bit in what I do. I speak with a lot of insurance companies. That's kind of a large part of my job. And I you learn little tricks with various systems on how to get a human on the line. And every insurance company has their own tricks. And that, after a while, you can kind of sniff them out. And it might be *8. It might be 00. You know, until. But yeah, there's fun and interesting ways of guaranteeing that you get a live operator. And one way of doing it is just not hit anything, just sit there, and it's like it thinks you have a dial phone or something. You don't have the ability to hit a key or something, and eventually a live operator will come on for that.
Yeah, it'll send you to a person, huh?
Yeah.
Or doesn't that one sometimes end with the sorry you're having trouble, goodbye? No.
Yeah, I've had that too, and that's yeah. A lot of fun. Each system is different, and you got to find find ways of navigating the maze.
But in your experience, those systems all ultimately have a person back there.
Usually, yeah.
If you can crack the code, you're going to find a human being back there somewhere.
That's right.
Because,
that's right.
Because
while it's time consuming and everything, I imagine there are ways in which it saves a lot of time, at least for the company. It may not save any time for someone that has to negotiate with a company like myself or our potential customers, but the amount of time that they have to deal with people on the phone, and in other words, they have to pay someone to sit there and have a job with benefits and they're paid an hourly wage, the amount of time that those people have to spend on the phone is probably reduced. And that's the reason the companies do that, is because they're not having to pay the AI, you know, salary with benefits. It comes down
right.
to that, I think.
Yeah, no, it's a pretty good deal from that side, as long as you're not losing sales, right? That's the thing you want to look at is like, wow, we're saving a lot of money on receptionists, but if you start losing $10 million in sales a year, you might go, that's perhaps not worth it.
Is that where Michael was going with that? We need to rebel and just not deal with these people, or?
Well, this was actually Josh.
Yeah.
He spends it in an interesting kind of set of projections about where things have to go, and he talks about the fact that ultimately what we're going to need is systems that don't just come with a bunch of pre-coded skills. At some point, they're going to have to be learning systems, that receptionist systems, and any artificial intelligence filling any function like that is going to be have to be something that starts to pick up on what's going on and makes those kinds of connections. Because, you know, you could have the dumbest receptionist in the world, and he or she would do better with that interaction that Josh had than the best IVR currently will forever, right? I mean, it'll never get any better at that, right? It's going to be exactly the way it is unless someone goes in and codes different knowledge into it, whereas the really, intellectually challenged receptionist of the human variety would potentially get a lot better at the job over time.
Well, you know, that airline's routing AI that you've dealt with, in some ways, I'm sure it outperforms humans. Is that your experience? I mean,
absolutely, it's a lot faster. Yeah. I mean, you have to you wait while it's doing things, but you never hear it going, is it one of those or is it click click click? You know, it's already jacked into everything, right? So that part of the interaction goes really fast. So yeah, it's highly efficient. But if I call and say, you know, I'm really interested in flying someplace where they have little blue fish, right? It's
it's not
nothing's
going
to happen there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, I might try that. That would be kind of interesting. I wonder if that would get me a human on the line if I said that. Or red. I don't know. Red or blue. What do you think? You know, start saying that kind of stuff too. Whereas a human being would, you know, I don't know, they'd hang up on you, right? They'd do something.
Maybe, I don't know, but I get where you're going.
Yeah, or, you know, they might say, Tahiti? I don't know, and, you know, book you a flight. So Josh starts talking about the fact that we're going to have to start seeing systems that learn in place of these just hard-coded systems. We're dealing with, quote-unquote, narrow artificial intelligence that is just strictly hard-coded, and they're going to have to start being able to get smarter and respond to situations that they're in and start developing that way. And if you make that self-improving, then you've got the beginning, really, of a path towards increasingly more complex intelligence. But the learning skills have to be innate to the programs, and currently they're not. So this is what he's saying is that ultimately, there has to be kind of a shift in the fundamental design of these kinds of systems, and I think that's the rebellion that he's really looking for is this design change in how these kinds of systems are set up, that they need to start getting smarter if they're ever going to be any better, because it's going to be kind of a slow crawl otherwise as they're, you know, incrementally improved. So I don't know. What do you make of that argument, Stephen? Does that make sense, or? Would you?
Yeah, well, I think it's going to happen. It's just one of those things that say 5 years ago we didn't have a lot of AIs. I mean, you had when you called a company, you would often have a deal where press one for this to reach this department, press two for that department. But that's not AI. It's pretty common now to run into the AI operators and. It's a little bit. It's a smarter and better system than just the simply, punching numbers, and I would say that. So it's improved substantially in just the last few years, and I think, stick around. I think it's going to happen.
Yeah, I think so. But I think I would agree with Josh that the next big shift that needs to occur is that, to some extent, these systems have to start taking in knowledge themselves.
Yeah.
They have to, in some way, be autonomous in terms of how they deal with new input and processing that, and
ultimately
updating their worldview based on that.
Ultimately, they could get a lot better at it than we, than a normal human. I could imagine a computer system that, it's been 3 years since you called American Airlines, but you call them back, it recognizes your voice and says, "Oh, hi, Mr. Bauermaster. recognize your voice.
yeah, that'd freak you out a little bit, right?
It would a little bit. I, you know,
really? Did I go to Ohio? I don't remember.
That's right. do you need to go back to whatever location you went to? You need to go back to Florida again?
Yeah.
So that's, I can imagine a situation like that where, I mean, and it could literally know the voices of thousands of people, which is a whole lot better than you could expect a human to do. So, yeah, I mean, that, I think that, you know, we have AIs that are already capable of learning somewhat in narrow fields. I think it's just a matter of time.
That'd be pretty cool, actually, if they, I know it's a bit of a tangent, but if they could just recognize your voice so they wouldn't have to ask for your account number.
That would be pretty cool, yeah.
They could just say, is this so-and-such, and then they could ask some verifying question because they've recognized your voice. And then when you have a robot secretary or agent working on your behalf, it imitates your voice perfectly. So you get these two robots talking to each other.
have my robots talk to your robots.
Exactly.
We'll
do lunch. Or they can, whatever works best. So I want to take this to the next step. A while back, actually not that long, last week, Josh had written a piece called More on the AI Takeover. And this is very interesting. He's having a little bit of fun with what he sees as the necessary stages from where we are now to what we would think of as the post-human intelligence future, the post-singularity future. He has some fun with this by setting these different types of robots out as different species. And so he gives us basically four different species of robots. And the first one is Robo-Insectus. And this is remote mechanical gadgets or thinkers with hand-coded skills. So hand-coded, again, it's like dealing with the IVRs, such as Roomba or industrial robots or automated call center systems or dictation programs. So that's where we are today. That's what we have, Robo-Insectus. Okay, so we've got robots all around us, roughly insectoid intelligence, but
hard coded to do just narrow tasks,
right? Like a worker ant is, you know,
exactly.
Or a termite or something. Now the next step, this is very interesting, is Robo Habilis, and here he gives the example of Rosie the housemaid. So intelligence at that level. You remember Rosie from the Jetsons?
Absolutely.
Yeah, actually, I think she was Robo Sapiens. I think she was actually the next stage up. But
in some ways, she was a lot smarter than the people she was taking care of.
She might have been a little post-singularity, actually. But the idea of you imagine a level of intelligence between the Roomba and the Phil Bowermaster, right? Something. You know, halfway between those two things, and you've got an intelligence that is able to handle certain jobs in the real world, but it's not a rocket scientist. Okay, it's not a it's not able to necessarily create new ideas. It's not looking for meaning in life, but it is actually able to do an awful lot of what we currently think of as just kind of regular work, and things like your housework, like picking up your house.
Stuff that we would rather not do. It could get out in the yard and mow your lawn. It could wash your dishes. It could do your laundry. And
you think about it, those are very complex tasks requiring a lot of learning along the way. Even if you're programmed to load a dishwasher, you know, you're programmed to load a hypothetical dishwasher, once you show up in a particular house, you're going to have to deal with the configuration of dishwasher that they have there and the shapes of the dishes that they have there and the peculiarities of the household. You know,
the peculiarities of that particular machine, you know, it might be a certain model which it's programmed to know, but, you know, maybe that particular machine, you know, it needs to be, the door needs to be wiggled just slightly in order to get it to turn on. You know, if your gadgets in your house are anything like mine, they, after a few years, Phil, they all get a little, they get quirks of their own.
Sure.
And if I were going to have a robotic household helper, they would have to learn those too. So yeah.
So think about the Roomba. skirting around your house, scooting around your house, sweeping the floors, and the kids are always leaving their toys lying around. Now, what's the Roomba going to do forever? Right, it's going to bounce off those toys and continue sweeping. Right, that's all it knows how to do. That's it. That's its life.
Robo Insectus.
Yeah, Robo Insectus. Robo Habilis is going to identify those as toys, pick them up, and put them away. And if they're different toys or if they're in different places, doesn't matter. Robo Habilis is going to be able to handle that transition and maybe even ultimately start doing sneaky things like, you know, hiding the toys that it's getting sick of picking up or something like that. Or, you know, accidentally breaking them or something like that. But,
sorting the toys. I happen to know that these particular toys belong to this kid, and they go in this room, and et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly. So this is actually our first of three easy steps. I said I was going to deliver us from subhuman to post-human in three easy steps. Well, this is the first of the three easy steps, and it's got everything going for it except for the easy part. From Robo Insectus to Robo Habilis. Okay?
All right.
We can make that leap. We're two steps away. Okay? So the next leap is from Robo Habilis to Robo Sapiens. And Josh's description here is up to and including rocket scientists, AI researchers, corporate executives, any human capability. So
this
now
is this is the morning I wake up, I say, you know, I just don't feel like going into work today. Robo Steven, go to the office.
Yeah.
Okay.
Phone in, be me, right? Yeah, now it's like instead of a toy on the floor, it's your laptop, and this system's actually capable of picking up the laptop, seeing that you've not finished an email that you meant to send, and finishing it for you and hitting send, okay? I'm not saying you necessarily want a robot to do that for you. I'm just talking about the level of complexity we're talking about now. This can do what you can do, or what any of us can do. It's a human-level intelligence. Thoughts, Stephen, on which is the bigger leap, from Insectus to Habilis or from Habilis to Sapiens?
Oh, definitely the second step. And not just technically, and frankly, I don't know if technically it would be more difficult to move from Insectus to Habilis or from Habilis to Sapiens. I'm not sure which is the harder technically, but I can tell you ethically, there's a whole conundrum. You know, do we treat these beings that are as smart as us as servants, as slaves? I mean, how do we integrate them into society if we don't? It's a pretty big leap. It'll be a major society shaking thing when that happens.
Well, you know, and what's interesting here is we're talking about a leap in capability, but this is a little bit sidebar. Actually, it's not. This is very much relevant and on the spot. This is something we have to figure out, or we will have to figure out eventually. We don't have to figure out tonight, but we will have to figure out. Is it possible that you could have that level of capability with a system that was not sentient, that was not conscious the way we're conscious?
I would say no. And the reason is, if it is objectively as flexible and as smart and as capable as a human being, then who are we to say that subjectively they're not having that machine's not having the same experiences? And so, I mean, at some point, at that point, you start having robo rights activists and things like that, you know.
So even if it's not conscious, from the outside looking in, we can't tell it's not. So we would have to assume that it is. Is that?
That's right. Yeah, I think that from an ethical point of view, I think we need to default on the side that it is. And in some ways, we that's what we have to do with each other anyway. You know, I mean, there's a psychological condition, and I forget the name of it. I apologize, but it's basically a person who believes that the rest of the world is just sort of make believe, and that the only thing real is themselves. And no one else has feelings like them. No one else, you know, it's all an illusion. And so you can imagine how
You're talking about solipsism, is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And
okay.
Thank you for that. And so, you know, you can imagine how morality might be of some difficulty to somebody like that. And, you know, sociopaths, to a great extent, are somewhat like that. I mean, no one else matters except for themselves. So, but, you know, most of us, we don't have that baggage. We deal with, you know, we accept other people as legitimate as we are, as having feelings just as we do, and you know, the whole golden rule, do unto others as you would have done unto you, is based on the idea that other people are just as important as you are, and therefore you should treat them as you would like to be treated yourself. So, and not just because they'll do the same. You know, it's not just it's assigning value to other people regardless of their ability to do for you, and we're better people if we live like that. And so, if we have these beings that are around us like robots that are every bit as capable as we are, and we treat them as if they're slave, you know, then in a way we've stepped back morally. To slave owners, and I don't think, you know, that wouldn't be good for us, let alone the beings that are our slaves.
You know, you're actually jumping ahead a little bit of where I want to go with this discussion, but this really interesting talk that Jaime Casio gave a few weeks ago in New York. He was there at the same time as the Singularity Summit was going on, and he was at this Future Salon where they were doing kind of this counter event, and it wasn't really anti-singularity. It was just kind of this very different, whoa, we got to think about some of this other stuff. We've got to take a different tack on some of these issues. And one of the complications in the three steps from subhuman to post-human intelligence that Jaime raises is exactly what you're talking about. And he had the slide he put up, and it said, "Rights: happy slaves don't mean ethical masters." And it goes exactly to what you're talking about, Stephen, because, you know, two of the possible objections to everything you just said is, one, where I was coming from initially. Well, they're zombies, okay.
Yeah.
They don't really have sentience, and I'm actually holding out the possibility that there could be highly capable systems, maybe not exactly like us, but highly capable systems that could fool us, but that don't have the same subjective kinds of experience that we have. One thing is, I would expect them to know that and be able to tell me that, but I don't know. If you weren't conscious, would you know it? At that point, we should be college freshmen sitting up late at night having those kinds of questions, with, you know, some help, if you know what I mean. But
I have no idea what you're talking about.
I have no idea what I'm talking about either. The other possibility is, well, they've been programmed to want to do whatever we want, right? That's the argument that actually I've made a few times, is that, well, what you're talking about is, you're talking about an intelligence, and it's as intelligent as we are, but instead of having this inward-facing drive to protect its own life and to take care of itself, it has this drive to take care of humanity, or to look after, you know, depending on the AI, to look after my best interests. And we will see systems like that. There's no question in my mind that there will be systems like that, and we will interact with them, and maybe it's perfectly ethical to evolve a system like that. I mean, if the system is completely happy by making Stephen Gordon happy, and then it gets to do that, is that a bad thing or a good thing?
Well, you know, we have in nature some examples of something that's pretty close to that. Look at the beehive, the way it's set up. Most of the work is done by bees that are not going to be reproducing.
Mm-hmm.
It's not its own genetic code that's going to be passed on. It'll be actually the queen's, and a few chosen mates for the queen. And they're doing all this work, and then they just die, and never having had any children of their own, any little bees of their own. So, but I mean, that's what they've been programmed to do. And in a way, I suppose it's sort of like they're part of a body. You know, I mean, the cells within my finger don't reproduce, but you know, they have a job to do. They do it so that the larger organism, in this case a body, but in the case of a hive, the hive can pass on its genetic material. So I suppose you could look at you know,
the big problem with both of those analogies being that the bees or the cells are not conscious sentient beings.
Right, exactly. But in the example you gave, Phil, you know, exactly. The question then becomes: are these robots? You know, are they just acting happy and they're not really happy, sad, or anything? They have no internal life at all. They're just doing what they need to do because they've been programmed to do it. Or are they flexible enough, smart enough, and they're really screaming on the inside, but their programming makes them look like they're happy? You know.
Yeah. Well, actually, it's two arguments. One is they don't feel anything at all. In which case, you know, from a strictly cynical standpoint, you go, well, then it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
And in some sense, it doesn't matter. The other one is they really do feel it. They have a rich inner life, but their rich inner life is all about making you happy, right? Because that's what they were set up to do. So, is that okay? Well, I think it probably is, as long as they're happy, right?
But that make us better people?
Or does it make us slave owners? And this is the point that you know, Jim A. raises. You know, are we slave owners by programming them that way in the first place? And happy slaves don't mean ethical bastards. I think is a really concise way of summing up the kind of ethical pitfalls we're gonna be facing here. I mean, this is a really tricky issue because we want these systems to take care of us. You know, ultimately, if you follow the Singularity Institute kind of philosophy on this, Michael, in one of his posts that we'll get to if we have time here in a minute, talks about the coherent, extrapolated volition of humanity. And you've got this singleton AI that is figuring out what we all want, or what we would want if we were smart enough to really know what's good for us, right? Because there's a real problem asking a 3-year-old what he or she wants. You know, they're going to say, I want to eat cotton candy every meal for the rest of my life, right? And that's not actually true. So if you start with the assumption that we're all 3-year-olds, this intelligence has its work cut out for us, trying to figure out what we're going to be when we grow up and what we would want then, and then turning around to try to make it happen. But step back from that model. Whether you think that's a great idea or whether you think that's a horrifying idea, you know, who are we to build a system and tell it that its whole purpose in existing, a conscious sentient system, that its whole purpose in existing is to do that for us?
Yeah, it's you know, we really got an ethical minefield ahead. We really do.
Yeah, it's going to be a big one. Well, anyway, that's the issues we'll start to encounter as we take that second step from robo-habilis to robo-sapiens. And then finally, from robo-sapiens to robo, I'm going to pronounce it, I guess it's Googolus, maybe Googolus, but anyway, he's playing on Google there. And this is a collection of top robo-sapiens wired together in a box, running at accelerated speed, equivalent to, say, Google, the company, and the search engine. And once you've got robo-Googolus, you're at post-human, and you're at the singularity, and things can get very wacky from that point on. However, one of the things that Josh says right off the bat is that our Googolus can't take over the world any more than Google could, although, you know, some would argue they're taking a pretty good shot at it. And then he says you actually have to get to the next stage, which he calls, and I like this one, robo-Uncle Samus.
Okay.
Which I guess it means you know, something more like the U.S. government with weapons and things like that in order to actually take over the world. But for me, I feel like we got to post-human by the time we got to robo-Googolus.
Well, it's interesting you should say that. Glenn Reynolds had come out with an article on the singularity that I believe was in Popular Mechanics. I believe he had
Popular Mechanics,
that.
Yes.
And in that particular article, it was basically a primer of here's what the singularity means if you've never encountered the idea before. But based on him having spoken with several folks, including Werner Benge and also Ray Kurzweil, his thought are what he's hearing from some of these guys is that we're going to see post-human intelligence in machines before we're able to upgrade ourselves. And I suspect that that's probably right. I would think that it would be easier to build smarter than human level intelligence from scratch than it would be to try to break into the native code that we have in our, in our heads and try to upgrade that. But I could be wrong.
Well, the thing is, I think for if there is such a thing as mainstream singularitarian thought, you just expressed a piece of it, right? Which is that
machines do it first.
Yeah, machines do it first. Machines do it faster. Now, this is actually one of the points that Jim A. took on in his talk, and he's of the opinion that there's a couple of things we have to look at. One is that we might start getting a lot better at enhancing our own intelligence a lot faster than we realize, and make some pretty remarkable jumps in the not too distant future. That's half the equation. Then the other half of the equation is, and also, actually creating intelligence in a machine, real, general intelligence, might just be a lot harder than we ever thought it was going to be. So
Right. When
those two things are both put into the balance, then it becomes it's coin toss, which one will happen first?
Yeah. So while it's mainstream a mainstream opinion, our thoughts as to how AI is going to go has been wrong a lot in the past. So it's possible we could be wrong about this as well.
Right. Well, he gives an interesting list of things that might hold us back. He talks about some of these I've thought about, but some of them I hadn't. And the first one was dead-end technology paths. They could cost us years and years. Just the fact that, and this has happened throughout the history of developing any new technology, is that frequently we start down the wrong path. And we spend a long time pursuing it, and as it gets less and less likely that anything's going to come from it, what happens? Well, they pour more resources into it rather than fewer. And dead ends really could cost us a lot. One of the things that I find encouraging, though, is that you see markedly different approaches to how we would get there, even from within this is such a weird term to use, but mainstream singularitarian community, right? As if there is such a thing, right? But you got Ray Kurzweil talking about, well, we could do it this way, or we could do it this way, or if all else fails, we
reverse engineer the brain.
We reverse engineer a brain, right? And Ben Goertzel talks about doing it a somewhat different way. And there are plenty of Bruce Katz, who we had on the show a while back, talked about other ways you might get there. So I'm not sure that a particular dead end is the end. It's only if they're all dead ends, right? And if we're not remotely looking at the right thing. But
well, they, for example, with Moore's Law, just when it looks like we're one level of putting transistors on a chip, one method of doing it plays out. It seems like there's always another method that comes along that, at least it has in the past, to save us and to keep Moore's Law clicking along nicely. And perhaps the same will be for the development of greater than human level intelligence. We approach a goal and all of us, and we're going down this path and everybody thinks, hey, this is the way it's going to be, and then we're all surprised it's not that way at all, but it's this other garage project that was going on, you know, with just a couple of guys somewhere privately that turns out to be the way. But we really weren't held back by going down this false, you know, this dead end. So I don't know.
Right.
Maybe it'll work out like that. Who knows?
Yeah, it's possible. I think that the dead end thing is possible. Certainly, the other thing he says that a lot of promising possibilities will go nowhere, for sure.
Yeah.
If we're looking at seven or eight different ways of doing it, they're not all going to lead there. Most likely, it's just like when we talk about energy, right?
Yeah,
you know, we
that's
spent
right.
3 weeks talking about energy. We talk about all these different scenarios and all these different things, and we probably will end up with quite an interesting mix. But not everything we've talked about is going to be a huge contributor to what our energy future looks like. Much less so probably our artificial intelligence future. Then other points he mentions, regulations, backlash against AI and related technologies. But I have to say that if there's going to be regulations holding AI back, boy, are there going to be regulations holding human modification back.
Yeah.
And if there's going to be a backlash against AI, there's going to be a much, I think, much stronger backlash against modifying the human brain. So...
Well, you almost would need a world government to hold it back. I mean, because, yeah, we could, you know, pass draconian laws here in this country because we just don't like the idea of AI, you know, artificial general intelligence. But is that going to stop it worldwide? No. In fact, probably a lot of scientists in the field that are currently in this country would go somewhere else and pick up their research in some other country that was supporting it. So, I can hardly imagine a situation where regulations would hold it back too long or too much.
Well, I think they could hold it back significantly if you look at human cloning, right? Where is it legal to do that?
And
I'm not asking rhetorically. I mean, informationally.
The only places that it would be legal to do that are places where they haven't gotten around to outlawing it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's one of those things that almost universally people, say, "Nah, we don't want to go down that path."
It's possible that that we might get far enough along with artificial intelligence that people really see some risk there, or sense some risk there, where it really goes against the grain with people the way cloning does, okay? And suddenly it becomes not universally but almost universally rejected. Well, then regulation really could make a huge difference because scientists who don't really have any place to go might actually then start focusing on other things, and it really could hold you back. But, to your point, it would have to be something that was more or less universally rejected, and there aren't very many things that end up in that place. Certainly, right now it looks to me like Asia is going full bore for this kind of research. China is looking into nanotech in a big way. They're looking into artificial intelligence in a big way. And, of course, Japan has always led in robotics. And I don't think that they're going to suddenly decide that this is creepy and scary and that they don't want to do it.
Yeah.
So if the West decides that, then, to your point, they're going to be the ones who get held back. But the research itself probably goes on, and the progress goes on. Without the West's contribution to it, whatever that might have been, I think it would probably be substantial.
Exactly. So, yeah, and I would say that places that have a demographic problem, like Japan, where they have an aging population and not enough young people to take various jobs, they're looking to robotics as the thing that's going to save them, and so they really are pushing forward as fast as they can and they're even deploying some robots that are probably doing things that they're not yet really good enough to do, but they're really pushing the issue. They're really pushing the technology as fast as they can go.
Exactly. Now, Sally's making some points about regulation in the chat room, talking about it would be like prohibition, making the interesting comparison to the feudal Chinese who burned their ships of exploration and relinquished that technology, and the West ended up conquering them rather than China was kind of in a position they could have pretty much had the whole world there at one point. True. I think I agree with that, although I'm also in favor of regulation around building gray goo, for example. I think it should be illegal to build endlessly self-replicating nanobots that turn everything they see into jelly. You know,
call me crazy, but
yeah, call me kooky, call me a stick in the mud, call me a buzzkill. But I don't think we should. I don't think that should be legal. You know, are people going to pursue it? Well, they might. I don't know why anyone would, but I think there can be a regulatory framework around attempting to do things rationally and safely, as opposed to a kind of superstitious framework that just says, oh no, that's not what nature intended, we're not going to go there. I think that's the big important difference between the two.
Yeah.
So where have we gotten to? We went from RoboSapiens to RoboGoogolus, and now with RoboGoogolus, I think you have a really interesting situation, because although they won't, you know, take over the world in the your robot overlords are here sense, they can pretty much take over the economy. And they're smart enough that we could pretty much by default put them in charge just because they're coming up with better ideas than we are, and we decide that it's to our benefit to let them be in charge. But when that happens, that's when you're going to see a huge transformation of the economy and the world. Actually, you probably will have seen it starting at the RoboSapiens point, won't you?
Yeah.
As soon as you've got robots that can function at the same intellectual level as a human being, then you've got the issue of it's no longer just the gas station pump attendants who are being automated out of a job. It's no longer just the checkout clerks at the grocery store, but it's all of us, potentially. Just as it's cheaper for those companies, as you mentioned, to put an IVR in place than to hire a flesh-and-blood receptionist, when it becomes cheaper for a software company to put an AI in place than to hire a product marketing guy, or when people find they can save a lot of money by going to a robo-lawyer rather than going to you, Stephen, that's a very different economy. And it seems like there will be a good deal of resistance to that, which isn't the superstitious dread kind of thing, but just people at least perceiving that they're acting in their own economic interests by trying to prevent that from happening.
That's right.
How do we get past that?
Well, that's a big one. I don't know. There was a short story called, I think it was Nanotech Comes to, Wichita Falls or someplace like that. That was the name of the short story, I believe. But anyway, the idea was that we all get replicators, okay, that could produce anything we want. And instead, you know, robotics is a similar problem in some ways. Instead of having to go to work, we get robots that we happen to own that go and do all our work for us, and we get the benefit of that wealth. And here we are sitting back, and we don't have to do anything. Okay. Society
okay, I like
falls
that
apart.
I don't know what I choose that option. That sounds good to me.
Okay. Well, and everybody in this story did. They chose the option of, if I want a Ferrari, I can. I'll have the large production facility spit me out a Ferrari, and that it just takes a few hours for it to do that, and so it costs very, very, very little, and so everybody gets all the goods they want and everything that you could possibly want that everyone can have, and it's just basically free, and. Eventually, anarchy results. It's just like, there's nobody has to go and do anything productive. You have all this time on your hands, and just society falls apart. I don't know. We got, a lot of things are going to have to change, so our ways of thinking about the world and everything would have to change if we either. Have machines that can build, like nanofactories or something that can build any good that we want, or if we have robots that can do all the work, and we're left basically, with little to do but all the money in the world. So,
well, I'll tell you where Josh takes it is he quotes Robin Hanson at length, and I won't read the whole quote, but he talks about the complementary effect of machines up through the R insecta stage, and he talks about how that has been much stronger than the substitution effect, so that as technology has improved, we have not lost jobs, we've gained jobs, and we've gained wealth out of that process. So does the complementarity hang in when you move up that next step, right, when you get to robo sapiens? And he gives this really interesting example. He says, right now we have a Moore's law for the robot's brain, but not for its body. In other words, we may enter a strange period where white-collar workers are replaced by beige boxes, but blue-collar ones are still cheaper for a little while than fully capable humanoid robot body. Okay, so Stephen, you and I, we get put out of work, okay, the marketing guy and the lawyer, we don't have jobs anymore, but like our landscapers still have jobs, right? Or the guy who, who's my example guy? I'm always using my sprinkler guy, right? He's still got a job, because he actually lays stuff in the ground, and that's a somewhat harder problem to solve, it turns out. Now, he says that'll disappear soon enough after nanotech manufacturing takes hold, but at the moment, it looks like AI may be a decade earlier than real nanotech. So one thing Sally suggested is we might want to go through the stages that get us to true nanotech next week, and that might be a fun discussion. But he says here, and we'll close with this, and we've got a lot more to say about AI, so maybe we'll spend next week on AI moving into nanotech, and then the following week we'll finish it out with nanotech. So we've got kind of a three-week series going on here, if that works for you.
Yeah, absolutely.
But he says the key thing to remember when thinking about the economic AI takeover is that it is not something we should be trying to prevent. Why shouldn't we, the human race as a whole, build machines to do the hard work we need done and spend our time enjoying the resulting wealth? And I think that goes back to the short story you just mentioned, Stephen. So I think we'll pick it up with that discussion next week.
The name of the short story is "Nano Comes to Clifford Falls," by the way, and it you can hear it as an escape pod. It was dramatized, so it'd be a fun listen. Our music this week, if you don't mind, I'm going to skip straight to it, Phil.
Stephen, before you do, I just want to say, next 2 weeks we're going to be on Sunday evening at the old time, so please tune in on Sunday evenings at the old time. Go ahead.
Okay. Our music this week is from Spady. And the song is "Anyway."
"Anyway," sung by Spady. All right. Well, thank you for putting that together, Stephen, and for your contributions this evening. Sally, thanks to you, to all our friends in the chat room, to everyone listening live. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. That'll be 9 p.m. Central Time on Sunday evening. Sally, thanks for asking that question. We look forward to being with you then. And until Sunday, live to see it.
Things.